Hi everybody, my name is Chris Deasy. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. And this week, I get to meet one of my best friends from school. It's Christopher Greenfield, who works in Abu Dhabi. Chris graduated from university in Cardiff with a degree in astrophysics back in the 1990s. He taught first aid with St John Ambulance. He became a school teacher, got invited to Houston in 1997, later became the head teacher of an international space school. He interacted with the astronauts. I think his life has turned out rather differently to mine. He did a master's degree there. Then in 2012, Christopher moved to Kuwait. And then during the pandemic to Abu Dhabi, where there is a big thirst, as Chris tells us, for knowledge about space. His dad first got him interested in astronomy. He had a telescope from a very young age. We learn about Chris's knowledge of the pop charts and Chris's ability to recall. In fact, this is a part of the interview where I think you'll find that we were, I think, pretty competitive at school. We used to always compare what we knew about what was in the charts, what was going up, what was going down. And all these years later, we still remember the same numbers. Chris talks about the first record he bought. He does online pub quizzes. We learn that his earliest memories involve hearing Rod Stewart and ABBA on the radio. Chris talks about the role of the subconscious for what our minds can absorb. We learn why Chris deleted Facebook, and he talks about what he thinks about social media and what he likes and dislikes about it, including fake news. Christopher talks about online teaching due to lockdown and about the possibility of going into space in the future as a tourist with Virgin Galactic. Christopher thinks there is going to be a golden age of space exploration. One day, someone will go to Mars, and Christopher hopes he will be able to say, I taught that person. He'd love to experience zero gravity himself and go into space. Christopher has been to the White House, to Buckingham Palace, and spoken to the United Nations. And if an opportunity comes up in life, he wants to snatch at it. Christopher talks about his foray into acting, including pantomime as Wishy-Washy, and he has even appeared in a film. He talks about how he never imagined when he was at school that he'd do anything like this. He talks about what it felt like to sit in the cinema and see himself on the big screen. Christopher remembers watching Spitting Image when he was young and how it was a programme that got us all talking about politics in the school playground. Christopher talks about some of the perils involved in talking about religion or politics. And at the end of the interview, we learn why Christopher is a glancing back but looking forward kind of guy. It was amazing to catch up with my good friend Christopher Greenfield for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is such a pleasure to catch up with Christopher Greenfield. At least I assume you're still Christopher. Are you Chris or are you Christopher?
You can call me Christopher. I do go by Chris, but yeah, my name's Christopher Greenfield, yes.
Yeah. And of course we knew each other. It's worth saying to our audience that we knew each other many, many decades ago when were both in the same secondary school, and we kept in touch for quite a few years after that.
We did indeed, that's right, yes. Those friendly school day memories, of course.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll return to quite a few of those. But also, of course, you've been on the media this last week. I've heard you talking about space missions and training astronauts. So it's quite a far, you know, a very circuitous route, I'm guessing, from the days when we went to the Bishop of London High School. So do you want to say a little bit about where you've been in the last, 30 years?
Oh, gosh, where do I start? Well, graduated from a university, Cardiff University, with astrophysics. And then wasn't really sure about what to do after that. I wasn't that keen on doing research. I did consider it, but I didn't think it was my field. So instead of that, at the time, I was volunteering with a local St. John Ambulance unit, and I was teaching first aid. And I figured that being a teacher might be something worthwhile of doing. So I spoke to my professors at the university. They said, yeah, this is very demanding, but you know, they think you know, you've got the persona to do it. So I became a teacher, got my first job at Stanwell. And as a result of my first job at Stanwell, I got invited to go across. They had this sort of link with a former pupil over in Houston who lived directly opposite from the Johnson Space Center. So he had a lot of contacts there. And I got invited in 1997. I got invited to go across to Houston to accompany two of our students that would go across annually to do like a bit of work experience at the Johnson Space Center. But this one year was a bit different because he wanted a teacher to come along, not just a chaperone, but he wanted a way of setting up some sort of international like academy really that was there. And as a result, I went across every summer. Even when I left the school, I was still going across every summer for about 15 years, supporting, became the head teacher of this International Space School. I was then director of education for it. And then eventually I ended up moving to Houston to do a master's degree in research with the university there, which was next door to Johnson Space Center. So I got to meet a lot of astronauts, got to interact with some of the astronauts, a lot of the NASA scientists, you know, people that when growing up, you know, when I remember going to my nan's house on the first space shuttle mission, when the space shuttle was launching back in April 1981. And I was already interested in space and astronomy at that time, and I was just absolutely fascinated by it. And yet here I was 16 years later in Houston in the Johnson Space Center, meeting the two people that were on board that space shuttle at that time. I just thought, wow, this is amazing. So I went across to Houston, did my master's degree there after doing 15 years of teaching in the UK, which brought me to Tregaron as well. I went to as head of science in Tregaron for a while. Moved across to the United States, did my master's degree there, and I was working on a PhD. But unfortunately, that was around about the time that the credit crisis hit around the world. And as a result, there was a lot of industries that were shutting down in around Houston and around the United States. So a lot of funding got cut. Of course, I was not an American citizen. I was an international student, technically. So a lot of our funding got cut as well. So we were offered, as international students, this opportunity to do something relating to, what was it now, seismology with nanotechnology, basically for the petroleum industry in Texas. And I looked at that, and again, thinking back to my days as an undergrad, I wasn't really that interested in that. I still felt deep down that teaching was my forte, teaching was my passion. So I decided then to look around the world. And I've always been fascinated by the Middle East, and I thought, well, I'll have a look at what teaching roles were there. So then in 2012, I moved to Kuwait to teach in Kuwait. So I've talked to a couple of schools in Kuwait, and then. Last year, moved to Abu Dhabi during the pandemic. Not an easy thing to do, moving schools, moving countries, you know, certainly. But now here I am in Abu Dhabi, and some of the things I got to do in Houston and in Kuwait involved linking to the International Space Station. So I provided opportunities for students to speak live to the International Space Station. I got students to speak live to astronauts, speak live to Virgin Galactic. And I did that recently. We did Virgin Galactic at my school as a virtual meeting on Teams back in December. And just about a week ago, we spoke to Mike Fink over at Houston. He was telling us about his three missions to space, you know, two to the space station, one on the space shuttle. And really, with the HOPE mission, the Mars HOPE mission that's just arrived in Martian orbit just over 6 days ago, it's, you know, the space really has captured imagination of students and public in United Arab Emirates, and more so than perhaps I found in Kuwait. But here is a really big thirst for knowledge and for understanding of space. And like I said, this opportunity I provided my students with, they really got enthused by it. And as I said, it's made national news here. Want to continue along that path with education and providing opportunities for students to speak to people who've been in space.
Yeah, and I was saying to you just before we started recording that in a way it's like you're chasing your dream, because I remember when I first met you, when we would have probably been both about 13, 14 years of age, that you were in contact with Patrick Moore, weren't
Patrick
you?
Moore. That's right, yes,
so,
it was.
So from the very beginning, and you were doing GCSE astronomy. Obviously, it wasn't offered in our school, but I remember.
No.
And you were always in the news about that. Cause, so you were at a very young age, you were doing something with a real passion that wasn't sort of mainstream in the sense what's available on the school curriculum. So that has always stayed with you.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I said it was my dad that really got me interested in astronomy. He bought a telescope one year, and I think it was about probably six or seven, maybe. I think it was very, very young. And he said, "Oh, look through this. Look what you can see through this." And he was showing me the moon and seeing these craters, on the moon and everything. I was just absolutely fascinated. And then I think my grandmother bought me an encyclopedia, I think either that year or the year after. And I was absolutely fascinated by the science section of that. I was looking at the physics aspect of that, and that interest, that as you said, passion, has just stuck with me all throughout my life since that young age and everything. It's got me into trouble as well. I tell the story to my students that because as a young age, you read all these science items in the encyclopedia, and I'd go and try out science experiments at home. With not very good consequences and results afterwards, but pouring my tea into my saucer and blowing on it to prove that evaporation happens faster with a larger surface area. Unfortunately, the contents of the saucer ended up on the brand new white tablecloth that my grandmother just put out for us for the afternoon tea, which was not a good thing to do, I don't think. But I couldn't blame it on the book anymore after that. But there we are. It was those sorts of things that I was just fascinated, and all through my school years, it was great,
Yeah, and it's funny because we knew each other so well, and yet, of course, we have so much in common. But it's interesting that both of us have taken very different paths in the sense that I ended up specializing in theology, and I obviously have been teaching in that same area for the last 20 odd years. And then you obviously doing work with space. And is it just interesting that only the other day when I was listening to the interview that you did on, was it Abu Dhabi, Radio Abu
It
Dhabi?
was a Dubai Eye, Radio Dubai Eye was here.
And you didn't. I was just listening, and I thought, how interesting that I know you so well, but never in all the years we never really we had so much in common that we didn't need to talk about our particular areas of specialism. But you'd
Absolutely
think
not.
anybody who knew us at the age of 14, which will come up, one of my questions in just a moment, anybody at that time would have thought that we were, specialists in the UK top 40 singles chart. Now,
Absolutely.
because in all of my interviews, I'm always saying to someone that when I was at school, I used to, Monday morning, half past eight, whatever, we'd always in the playground be talking about what our favourite songs, whether they'd gone up the charts, down the charts,
Absolutely.
and that's something that was far more defining. And I see that now because for years, I think, for many years, maybe because I was trying to present myself as a very serious academic who, was with people who were a generation older than me. Who didn't necessarily, I think that's actually not the case from the interviews I've done, when it turns out that actually there's far more to people have more of a hinterland than sometimes that you imagine when you work with people 30 years older than you. But what I found really interesting is that in interviewing people, a lot of the passions that would come out wouldn't be, oh, I always wanted to be, a university lecturer, or wanted to be a teacher. The things that really inspired them were gigs they went to, records they bought, and things that actually say more about them than the job. The
Absolutely.
job, we know them because they write books or because they teach, or particular I mean, my own students would know me for particular reasons, but they may not be aware of some of the things that I would consider to be far more core to who I am. But for you've done that to a degree that when I saw you, well, 17, 18 years ago, I think we met up in Cardiff one Sunday before Christmas, suddenly you were remembering like chart positions of stuff, Carly Simon coming around again or something. I was thinking, how do you do this? So I want to, because this
I
has been
still do
my
it as
obsession.
well.
You still do it. So how did that start, and how has that followed you through?
I don't know. I think. I mean, I've always felt when I teach my students about physics, I tell my students that physics allows you to become very methodical with the way you recall certain things, and it's very methodical, very logical manner. And for me, because I've had friends ask me this before, for me it was more of a case. I think I've just got very good recall at the moment, it's not just about the memory, it's just the recall. And I remember I was in Kuwait. It was very early on in my teaching year in Kuwait. We were coming back on the bus, and I think there was about 14 of us teachers in this minibus. And somebody said, because they were being bored, they just said, "Oh, go on. I'll give you a fiver if you tell me what was number one on the date of my 10th birthday." And I said, "Okay, what was the date of your 10th birthday?" And they told me, and I said, oh yeah, I know what it was, because it was March 1993, and I set off the Bluebells, I think, and Young at Heart. And they looked it up, and they went, my gosh, you're right. Mm-hmm. And out of the 14 teachers that were accompanying me on the bus on the way home then, I think I got 13 right, spot on. There was one, you know, like at certain time, I think it was 1999, and it was like there was a lot of sequential number ones for 1 week only. And I couldn't quite narrow. I got the two either side of the one it actually was, so I didn't quite get that one. But they were just amazed, and they said, "How'd you do that?" And I said, "I don't actually know, but when I hear a song, it reminds me of the emotion I was feeling at that time, and I didn't realize I'd like kept all these emotions with me, and that's why I think right, going back to when." I used to record the charts. I used to write them down as a list. You know, I'd only do the top 20, but it just by writing things down, you tend to recall it a lot better, you know, and I say that to my students when I'm teaching physics, say, if you want to learn these equations, write them down a couple of times and you'll be impressed at how quickly you can recall it. And I think it's just from that, I think just by writing it down, I remember writing down like number 8, you know, Bon Jovi, Bad Medicine in one particular year, week in August of 1989, for instance. It just happens to be there. And I think just by realizing, you know, because I listen to the radio a lot, even now I still listen to the radio a lot, you know, even at home I'll listen to BBC Radio 2 online, you know, and even now I'm hearing songs, and my sister and I used to watch the chart show on a Saturday morning as well. That would be good. So music was always there in the background, and that would just became just a second interest of mine, really, you know.
Yeah, no, because concretizing things, it's exactly the same with me, because I used to color code them. I sent you a photograph the other day of a random chart from February 1989, and it's interesting because I think at university, because I did start towards the end of my undergraduate degree, I was certainly writing everything on computer, but I was certainly handwriting essays at the beginning. And think that having that sort of color-coded sort of approach of absolutely concretizing everything, and it's why I think I've always kept a diary, because it's that sort of sense of if something is important, if something really matters, memories fade. And this is my worst feeling. I really struggle with people, and it can happen in a relationship context. It can happen in anything, you know, even at a meeting in work, when somebody will tell you a version of reality and you think, that's not right, or I don't recognize it. And of course, if you've got a record of everything, that's an author, you know, I mean, okay, if somebody could, can, you know, but if you've got a record of everything you've done for the last 30 years of your life or so, and you wrote it on the day, and there's a factual entry that you went to a certain place and you wrote it at the time, then if somebody says, oh, I never went there, or, you know, then you say, well, you know, but this all fits, and it ties in with everything else that's there, and you may even have, you know, some form of evidence or proof that you went, or something, that, you know, so all of those things are true. And I've always done that, but I used to find that writing the charts on a Sunday, if you've got a passion for something, then rather than listen to this ephemeral experience, because it can happen with films as well, which I watch rather a lot of. It's frustrating if somebody says to you, oh, have you ever seen so-and-so? And you think, I think I really liked it. Oh no, you got me thinking now, I can't remember, I'll have to look it up. And you're thinking, if it meant that much to you, have a review of it. I now review all the films I watch. And it takes time, but if I didn't do it, it would be more frustrating, and it would also feel that I was frittering my life away. So we both did the same with the charts. But the inevitable question, what was number one when you were born? Or don't ask me to work it out. Obviously, I know that you're only about 2 months younger than me.
I know that anyway, because and it's quite an interesting one. It's actually Gary Glitter, leader of the gang. August 1973.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's with me, as somebody who is so into the charts of that era, certainly as with you in the 80s, it's really funny that the song that was number one when I was born is actually one that I'm a bit like, meh, you know, don't care. And it was, unless you want to work it out, June 73.
Gilbert O'Sullivan?
Oh, no.
Guess. No,
I think he was around that. The one was Wizard.
Oh, Wizard. Okay.
And See My Baby Jive.
That's right. Yes.
Which is fine. But not one of the ones that particularly sort of stand out. But no, I'm the same as you. And and would sometimes think, well, what was number one when you were born, and that sort of thing. And it's and it's become a little bit, and it's an interesting, because that's my way into people. We all have our ways of when we meet people, particular things that we associate them with, particular Absolutely. Whether it might be books that they write or particular interests that they have or sports they play, and so that's my little sort of like way into people's biographies. But you still do it. So you mentioned that you still listen to the charts on Pick of the Pops every week.
I still listen to Pick of the Pops, and sometimes if I'm listening with someone else, someone else is there, I'll say, right, I'll try and work out what's likely to be on the show at that time. Now, before the DJ announces it. So I think, is it Tony Blackburn, I think, presents it now, is it?
Paul Gambaccini at the moment, but he was doing it about 4 years ago, yeah.
That's it, yeah. Because I remember Alan Fluff Freeman presenting it, bringing it back in the 1980s. And
he did it on a Sunday lunchtime at 12:30.
Right, yes, yeah. Yes, that's it, yeah. I remember that. And I think did Dale Winton present it as well late 90s, I think?
Yeah, he did it until 2012, and it's interesting because it was obviously pre-recorded.
Yes,
And when Fluff did it, it was live, and he had all the handover with. Are we allowed to mention DLT and all that? But he would do it in a very sort of live way. And it was the chart from like my parents' generation, because 1961 always seems to appear, which was year my mum left school. So there's always she'd say, I remember Helen Shapiro, not, you know, from that era. So it was like, so Sundays at 5 o'clock were precious because it was our chart. It was the
Absolutely.
Stuff I was our generation yes. were buying.
Bruno Brooks.
A few hours earlier. You know? Yeah. And a few hours earlier, we'd have the charts from our parents' generation. And so it was a good way of everybody sort of sitting around and thinking, oh, I remember buying that record when it came out. So there's a lot of intergenerational coming togetherness, which I think the chart shows used to do. But no, in the Dale Winton years, it was clearly all pre-recorded. But Tony Blackburn did it live, and then at the moment, obviously due to COVID, it isn't. And that's the excitement of having something that's about what happened 40 years ago, but it's no less present, it's no less real, because people listening, and it doesn't happen so much with Paul Gambaccini, but people would contact Tony Blackburn and say, oh, when that was in the charts, that's when I passed my driving test, or I met wife stroke husband, or had the holiday of a lifetime, or left school.
And that emotion, that it reminds you of that time, and I have some reason, I just have a good recall of that.
So he'd read all that out. So it's interesting that we both got that interest. But can you remember things like first record you bought?
Let's think now. Right, the first record I bought because it was in the chart at that time was probably, it would have been around early 89. So I'm thinking it was probably Guns N' Roses' Paradise City. But prior to that, when I was working as a paper boy in Ely, the news agents that I would have there would sell like records from about 2 or 3 years previous, and they would be sold at like 50 pence or something. So I'd buy a couple of those, you know, from time to time. But the one that the first one I bought, because it was in the charts and I heard it in my grandfather's car, was Guns N' Roses, Paradise City. And then after that, that was about when Madonna was number one with
Like a Prayer.
Like a Prayer, that's it. Sorry. I had it on the tip of my tongue then, but yeah, Like a Prayer. And then later on, that's when I started buying quite a few records, because then I think a few weeks later I bought the Roxette song, The Look. I bought then Gladys Knight's License to Kill a few months later, I think. I bought the Queen album as well, The Miracle, because that came out, I think, around about the time we started our GCSEs as well. Mm-hmm. Which, incidentally, the Soul to Soul, Back to Life was number one when we started our GCSEs.
I know. I was watching actually it was only last weekend, they were showing a retrospective 1989 Top of the Pops compilation.
Okay.
And it was all there. Soul to Soul were on it. And it had lots of Jason Donovan, and Sonia. That was also all that July of 89.
That's right.
Mike and the Mechanics. Yeah, gosh, that really took me back. And that was, you're right. And even like GCSEs, I still think to this day, what's the song? Rooms on Fire. It wasn't
Stevie Nicks.
Stevie Nicks. And it's those sort of things. And also when we got our GCSE results, I think it wasn't. We thought it might have made it to number one, but it was Poison by
Alice Cooper.
Alice Cooper. So again, whenever I hear those, Patty Booth stuff, you know, with that, I kind of think, you know, that was weird. But that is also symptomatic of a time. But I think it's, and I've tried to process this because I think the way that I've always tried to compartmentalize and classify things is I was doing it without, I mean, I think my parents used to despair a little bit because I'd be up in my bedroom at 5 o'clock on a Sunday because now you can listen on catch up, et cetera.
Absolutely.
But in those days, if you missed it live, that was it. And you know, if you didn't get a chance to write it down, I suppose, other than teletext, there was no opportunity to follow it through. So I'd be listening to all of that. And I think there was a point when it was sort of like, you know, are you going to do that like for the rest of your life? Or is this just a
No, actually, not at all.
The funny thing is, I'm not remotely, I mean, my children, I've got no, even though I've looked it up, no interest in what was number one when they were born. But the stuff that interested me has never gone. Now, that's the funny thing. So the interest is there, no less real than it was then. But I haven't necessarily, unlike in film, where I do watch lots of new films, and that's all that's followed through. But the musical interest are very much stuck in that sort of 80s period, really. It was when New Kids on the Block came along in end of 89. Right, yeah. And I just thought, not really for me anymore. Yeah, it's funny. That was just the point where I didn't feel that I was connecting anymore with what was out there. But that's why I still listen to all the retrospective Sounds of the 80s type programs.
Absolutely.
Sounds like you do.
Yeah, exactly. I do that as well. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And you mentioned something to me the other day about pub quizzes that you do. Yes. So you're the person. So when you hear the intro, I should have set a little challenge for you, shouldn't I? I should have put a couple of tracks on. But so within 5 seconds, you're able to identify the song.
Yeah. And when I was working in Kuwait, one of my fellow physics teachers there, Joe, at the end of every term, he'd say, "Okay, Mr. Greenfield, let's just test your knowledge. I'll play a YouTube video off his phone." And he said, "Right, I'll play you 5 seconds." He said, "You've got to know the song in 5 seconds." And you know, in quite a few of the cases that you know, I've been able to identify it very, very quickly. So I just don't know why. You know, I don't get every single one. Don't get me wrong, you know, but I enjoy doing pub quizzes, particularly if there's a music round. My sister does as well. More recently, with my family, during this lockdown, I did 12 straight weeks. I ran a quiz for my family, 12 straight weeks, and then obviously then when I was in the process of moving here to Abu Dhabi, then obviously I couldn't do it anymore. But what we did then as well with my theatre group in Kuwait, staging Kuwait, and now more recently with my family, we do this the online one that's called Chris and Ryan's online pub quiz, and they have a music round, and so we play along as one family group, you know, so one big team. And again, one of the questions came up this week: what's the current UK number one single? And luckily, I've been looking at the charts like a few days previous. It was Olivia Rodrigo, and I think it's Driver's License, I think it's called, something like that. And so some of these songs I haven't quite heard. If I played them on YouTube, I'd probably recognize it, like I said, because I do listen to the radio still a lot when I'm driving to and from work. But those pub quizzes, and everywhere that Claire and I have been, if we see there's a pub quiz on, Claire looks at the sign. She sees me looking at the sign and she says, "Go on then, let's go do it." And in December, either on my own or with Claire, I won 5 quizzes straight in different locations in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And I've got all these prizes, which I can't do much about now because during the lockdown. So it's like, what do I do with these now? So I've given them away to my friends that year. It's like, you know, but yeah, it's not the winning. It's just I enjoy the challenge. I enjoy, you know, the recall. I enjoy, you know, the aspect of you know, testing my knowledge. And again, the winning is not what I'm there for. It's just the enjoyment of participating in it. You know, the recall, like I said, and you know, trying to work things out, trying to, you know, guess what the answer is on different questions and things. And like I said, you know, there's some questions I just haven't got a clue on. I just don't know. It's not my expertise, but there are some, you know, I'm pretty good at, you know.
So if you were on Mastermind, that would possibly be one of your specialist topics.
If it was like Christmas number ones or Eurovision Song Contest entries in the 80s, perhaps, you know, I may, maybe, possibly, but with the general knowledge, I don't know. I think I might struggle with that a bit. I don't know. I don't think my knowledge is quite up to their standards yet, but.
Yeah, no, it was funny because we had a just before Christmas this year, we had a staff student quiz one of my, well, we all had to submit questions for our own subjects. I did something on Christmas films. And that was all very good. And then we weren't allowed to take part in our own rounds for obvious reasons because we knew the answers. Yeah. So it was sort of engineered. That's what I tell myself. So the students would win. It's my way of saying, why did I come like 9th out of 10? You know, and I thought, I have to redeem myself here because the student must be thinking, God, we're doing better than him. You know, he's our lecturer. He puts to know everything. And then one colleague said as an aside afterwards, and he said the question that nobody knows among his students anyway, is which artist, and I thought, you know, you're kidding me, right? Everybody knows this. He said, which artist had number ones in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s? Mm-hmm. And then somebody, and I thought,
yeah,
well, Richard. Of course it is. So, and then somebody said, I know. And they said, is it David Bowie? And I thought, oh, come on. I know it. So then I thought, I have to up the game on this. And I said, no, it's Cliff Richard. Mm-hmm. And then jokingly, they said, oh, come on, Chris. You're probably going to claim now that you know them all. So anyway, when I then started rattling off, I only did one per decade. I didn't.
Okay, that's fine. Okay.
And the look.
I'd struggle with the 50s, to be honest. I think I could probably tell you one from the other decades, but the 50s, I don't think my memory goes back that far.
No. Well, the famous one, which wasn't a number one, was Move It, because that was I actually saw Cliff Richard's car in Leeds Castle once. We had to leave early because we were there for the afternoon, but he was performing that evening, and because there was a big Cliff Richard show, and in the courtyard was this very expensive looking car, and the number plate was Move It. It's like, oh, come on, you know, drawing attention to yourself. But no. 50, I suppose. Living Doll, that was 59, I guess.
Taking Back to Number One in 1986 with the Young Ones, I think, as well, wasn't it? Yes.
I think we were really competitive. I think anybody listening to this can see them there. We're trying to,
No. I just do that anyway. It's not to compete with anyone.
No. I think it's great. No, but the only one I could remember from the 60s, even though there's Summer Holiday and the Young Ones, I guess, was 60s, was Please Don't Tease. And I thought afterwards, and it was a number one, thank goodness. But he only had one in the 70s.
Right. Which was probably, it Love Don't Live Here Anymore?
We don't talk anymore.
Oh, Don't Talk Anymore. Sorry. Okay.
And then of course he got, you know, his Christmas number ones became legendary.
Mistletoe and Wine and Millennium Prayer, Saviour's Day.
There we are. So there we are. There we are. So if I'm on Mastermind, we there'll be no shortage of topics. Very, very.
You just got to be millionaire. I'll be your phone a friend.
Yeah. That's right. But what about things like earliest memories, Chris? Going all the way back. What can you remember from growing up in Cardiff?
Earliest memories. The earliest memories I have again. Be listening to songs on the radio. I think the earliest one I remember is probably Rod Stewart's Sailing, 1975. We'd have been about two. Probably about then. I remember hearing in 1976, I remember hearing like Dancing Queen by ABBA and Elton John's Don't Go Break My Heart. So I have those as early memories, you know, traveling around in Cardiff and that, you know. So those are probably my earliest memories and that.
Interesting then that your earliest memories are music based. How interesting that.
Exactly, I know.
Because I wasn't necessarily expecting that answer, but I guess it's entirely apt that your answer would be based around what you remember listening to at 2 or 3 years of age.
Absolutely, I know. And as I said, you know, my parents love listening to the charts on a Sunday afternoon. My dad really enjoyed, you know, listening to music and that. So probably a lot of it was centered around just listening to music. I mean, we had a TV, don't get me wrong, but it seemed like listening. And even now, when I'm doing like work and things at home or doing something, I'll have the radio on in the background, because with a radio, listening to radio or podcast or something like that, you can still engage with that, but you don't have to concentrate like you do with a TV or, you know, if you're watching something on Netflix, for instance. And I think that's what was quite good, because, you know, particularly like if you're driving, you know, you can listen to something and you will absorb it into your subconscious. And sometimes it's that subconscious, you hear something again and you think, I've heard that before. And I don't know if you remember, Chris, when we had Mr. Wallace as our English teacher, I remember that triangle he would draw on the board. When you say, here, this is your conscious, and here's your subconscious, and look how much bigger it is, because you can store a lot more in your subconscious. And he was always telling us, even as an English teacher, he was telling us a lot of science and things back in those days, saying, well, look how much your mind can absorb, and it's there. He said it's documented, and you know, you've got to find a way of accessing it, you know. And as I said, you know, I found that incredibly perceptive, and it stuck with me all through these years. I'm still thinking that's probably how my mind works and recalls everything, perhaps. I don't know, but
yeah. And I wonder actually if it's almost as though in a sort of Back to the Future way, it's almost as though my future self has interjected himself into bits of my past, because there are things that I did 20, 30 years ago which are so important to me today. It's almost as though I needed, for example, when I went to university, I started doing lots of it's probably illegal, but you know, recording from the radio. No, because I only played it for myself. Recording stuff from the radio,
and of course,
recording lots of songs. We all did that sort of thing. But then I digitized all the tapes, and I've got 90 hours worth of this. And it's just I like this song. A lot of mainly Radio 2 by that point. Yeah, and so finding, but when I listen to that now. Mm-hmm. It's not just the music, because the music might be from 30 years earlier. It might be stuff from the early 60s, which I was listening to in the early 90s, which in itself probably set me apart from a lot of university friends, because I was not so interested in the stuff from the time. I was much more interested in those, you know, nostalgia-based radio shows that we've just been talking about. But what's interesting is that I'd record all of that stuff on when I was in my room, while I was working on my essays. That's the thing. So that's the soundtrack to my academic work.
Like, absolutely.
When I'm driving now and I listen to all those tapes, but when I'm there, what I remember is, even though I've heard the tapes multiple times, it's the first recollection of hearing it and pressing that record button that I remember very distinctly. And I can, and the voices, kept a little bit of the presenters' voices just before and after. Yeah, and a lot of those presenters have now died, Jimmy Young. Yeah, you know. And it's interesting listening to all of that now, because it really takes me back to a very particular milieu of being, you know, and it might be, oh, that was the day I got my degree result, or that was the day when I had an exam, or the day when I met somebody and all the rest of it. So they're all, so listening to all this these years later, what it does to the memory, and I get very possessive of it, because very... so elementary, you know, to who I am, that if somebody then comes up with a different, not a different view, because obviously some people may hate the music. My children often switch off when Dionne Warwick's Heartbreaker come on, which actually, after about, you know, 35 years on, I thought, actually, this is rather good. And then I hate Heartbreaker. One of my twin sons actually once said, he said, I don't want to listen to Heartbreaker. I want to play video games. And I'm thinking, what an interesting... Heartbreaker. It's like they're not... Yeah, exactly different sides of the same coin. It's like, it's a very specific song from the early 80s and a whole genre, you know. You know, it's not that choice is not the only one on offer. But no, it was really funny, because what that then does... everything else fits around that. And it means that you can be really sure you have such an investment, an emotional investment in particular times, places, people. And when, like you now, because I haven't spoken to you in 15 years, but immediately, more than that, even 17 years, when we just started speaking a few minutes ago, suddenly we are taken back to 1989 or any of the other years.
Absolutely, definitely.
About. And I find that really interesting. And I think it's because I've never lost touch with that whole, I may not have seen the people, but you know enough of what they meant.
Yeah.
Very few people have I... in fact, very few have I met up with, and you think, oh, that's not the person I thought they were. Generally, you just pick up from where you left off all those decades.
Absolutely.
And that, to me, is very precious. Have you had the same kind of experience?
Absolutely, I have indeed. Yes, definitely. Yeah.
And have you found, through whether it's social media or otherwise, both of us have busy lives, busy jobs, but do you find that you have managed, because we left school in an age when, as I was saying to you just before we started recording, we'd all be giving each other our phone numbers. Or obviously our parents' home addresses, because we didn't have social media in those days. We didn't have email.
Not at all, no.
And it's not much use 10, 15, 20 years later. But did, in many ways, obviously we kept in touch, but have you found that you've managed to keep in touch with a lot of those friends from school years?
I think... Probably not as much as I'd like to. I think when I was on Facebook, I joined Facebook probably a couple of years after it was launched, I think. And then I think the novelty was there, catching with people that you hadn't seen for a while. It worked out well. But then I think for me, I got turned off Facebook, I think, when it was just too many things on it. I just couldn't keep up with everything that was going on, and I deleted it, I think, about 8, 9 years ago or something like that. But at the time, I had Twitter, and I still use Twitter now. I don't tweet very much. I just retweet stuff about space or rugby usually, and sometimes the occasional thing about music from time to time. But yeah, LinkedIn was the one I think I liked, because again, it's more of the professional aspect of what Facebook was intended to be. And I prefer that. I think I prefer the professional aspect of it, particularly now. I've only just recently, in the last couple of months, joined Instagram because my cousin convinced me to join Instagram, and what she wanted me to like some of her posts and things. She wanted followers. So I said, okay, fair enough. I joined that. But again, I don't really do much on there. I might post the odd picture, maybe from like a week or so ago, or something like one from one week to the next. But I don't really use it very much. And I think, the moment I use Twitter really just to keep in touch with everything that's going on. That's one of my main. Keeping my finger on the pulse with everything that's going around the world, in this day and age, we got 24 hours of news every single day, online, on the TV, and sometimes you want to just like switch off from that. You want to find out what else is going on, because they will go with major news stories, continuously, and sometimes it's the same hour repeated over and over and over again. And you think, well, I just want to like find out something new. And for me, that's what Twitter was. It was like finding out other things that are going on around the world, other than what's just being presented to you on mainstream media at the moment, And like I said, that's why I like, reading aspects about space, particularly now with the UA Space Agency with their mission to Mars right now. And just following, what else is going on around the world, what else is in news at the moment, and sometimes, particularly with this pandemic that's been ongoing, we just want to switch off away from that. And I think that nostalgia you talked about just a few moments ago, I think is one of the things that's is helping people to come to terms with this lockdown, with things going on around the world, like I said. And that's why, my family, we set up this weekly quiz, and I said 12, 13, 14 weeks straight. I think I did a weekly quiz, which I ran for them. It was like a bringing together, and it was bringing that nostalgia back. We'd have different rounds. Some of it was like odd news stories that happened this week or something. Others, it was a whole round of sport. Others, it was things to do with music and whatever. And I'd always do a music round as well, And again, it's the music round. I think it's quite popular because it's, as you said, it's that soundtrack, and it's that soundtrack. You hear a song you haven't heard for a very long time. And it brings back those happy memories for you, and that's what key to all of this is. I think social media sometimes can be a little bit detrimental, I think, to people's mental health sometimes. There's a lot of what they call it, bad news, fake news, fake things, posts and whatever online, and sometimes when some people, I fear, become in such a state that they believe everything they see. It's probably going back when the TV first was like commercialized. People believing everything they saw on the TV, and then some people saw it a way of manipulating people. So it was another way of doing that, which is a shame. But like I said, people are people, and the thing goes on, unfortunately. So hopefully this pandemic will end, and we'll get back to as normal a life as we possibly can.
Absolutely, because a few years ago, I was actually talking to one of my PhD students who's from North Africa, and she was, and she's a practicing Muslim, and she was not. This was around the time that Donald Trump was elected, and I remember, and we were talking about this, and I found out the result. I was not expecting the result, but I thought that Hillary Clinton would win. But I found out on the BBC News website, as quite sort of normal. And she said she found out on Facebook, and I found this so interesting. I think one of my undergraduates was actually doing a project on this, because it was about how people use news and consume news. That for me, I would auto if somebody says, oh, there's some a major news story, I'd go immediately to BBC News. I wouldn't go to Facebook. For that. Now, that's interesting, because you might get a sense on Facebook of what your friends, the people you trust, think about something.
Yes.
Utterly get that, but I'd want the primary news to come from a source that I would consider to be authoritative.
Reputable.
Yeah. And you've hit the nail on the head that, whereas when we were at school, I would sit down and with my parents, we'd watch the 6 o'clock news every evening,
Right.
I wouldn't do that. Although that said, what I would do now, I'd find the stories, I wouldn't, I'm not interested in perhaps business news, I might not be interested in health stories or something, I don't know. So I'd go to the particular, to the politics or, the things that really interest me. So then I'm being selective. But what's interesting is that, as you say, some people will just find what they're looking for. And they'll only understand what their particular communities or their particular go-to people think. And so what then happens, and that breeds, as you say, fake news, because they're not looking for something that can be corroborated. They're looking for something that matches their own, whether it's their greatest fears or their greatest hopes. And that then is the starting point. So I was a bit surprised. And it says something, but it's a generational thing. To go to Facebook as a source of news. But I think you're right. You have to tread very carefully through fear then of somebody posting something which could then be, could be anti-Semitic, or it could be whatever it might be, it could then, somebody will take that as, well, I read it somewhere, therefore,
it's gonna be true.
Yeah, exactly. And then you end up with a American president who sort of almost seems to, sort of like do what no president before him ever did. And that sort of makes you rethink this whole sense of objectivity and reliability and trustworthiness. So you're right. I use Facebook a lot for things like film reviews, which is an odd place to do. It is an odd thing to do. But also it's my way of saying I've watched this and I get live. I watch the films maybe in a very solitary way. I go to the cinema on my, obviously not at the moment, because of lockdown, I'll go on my own. And I prefer that. I choose what I go to see. I don't have to bargain with somebody and say, no, it's not my sort of genre. But then share it afterwards with everyone, and people will say, oh, that's, on the basis of that, I want to see it, or don't want to see it. Or I had, interestingly, recently, you mentioned Gladys Knight a moment ago in the Bond films, but I watched all the Roger Moore and the Timothy Dalton Bond films, and that was interesting, because people I know and work with all really falling out with each other, but playfully about these things, that some really just couldn't get Roger Moore, that sort of thing. Very interesting what that does. You put up a review of something and then it's the conversation that it generates is actually very interesting, and it really makes you understand what people's motivate. People are very precious, because if they grew up with a particular bond, then that is the that's the definitive bond, and they can't
remember
of somebody.
I remember our friend Chris, our mutual friend Chris, we met up a few years ago before Christmas, I think, and I remember when we were at school, his best bond was always Roger Moore. Regardless of what everyone else said, he said, no, that's my bond, Roger Moore. And, it was very sad, obviously the recent passing of Sean Connery and Roger Moore a few years earlier as well. It's as you said, people in their lives have a soundtrack to their life. They also have a particular character that has been played by a certain actor that they grow up with, and I'm not just saying James Bond. I mean, there's lots of people that say, who's your Doctor Who as well, and those types of things. So it's as you said, it's very precious to people, because it connects them then to their past memories, to their favorite memories of going to the cinema, seeing a movie on the big screen. And as I said, it's something that people keep with them, forever. And having that connection is something that helps guide people through this this difficult time of the pandemic at the moment,
Absolutely. And how has life changed for you because of the pandemic, in the sense that you're teaching your students, I'm guessing, what, face-to-face, or is a lot of it on Zoom these days?
From last February, all the schools closed in Kuwait, so we had to do all our lessons online. We were using Google Classroom back in Kuwait. And when I came to Abu Dhabi, initially the first month or so we were teaching, it was on Microsoft Teams. And then the older year groups, the GCSE year groups and above, so year 10 and above, rejoined the school in face-to-face. Not every single one of them. Some of them chose to stay online, because some of them are still out of the country. They still can't travel at the moment. So that was better, but But still, it wasn't like the full population of students that were in school. Now, hopefully next week, hopefully if all goes to plan, all students should be able to return now. And again, it's that light at the end of the tunnel. You know, we need to find that that beginning of the end of this pandemic. And I think that's going to help a lot of people because you know, people have struggled. You know, staff, students, you know, families have really struggled with this lockdown in different parts of the world for various different reasons. And and you know, I said hopefully one day people will look back on this time history and hopefully we'll see the positives that come out of it, you know, brought families together. Like I said, with my family, we still do a weekly quiz. We're doing that now almost for a whole year, which prior to this wouldn't have happened. You know, so as I said, I know this pandemic is a really horrible thing, and I know, you know, people have died, and you know, and I know of people who've had the virus and been seriously ill in hospital. And that, you know, so I'm not saying, you know, it's a positive thing. I'm just saying, hopefully, we will look back and see what positives have arrived out of it, rather than you know, just looking back on it on a very bad period of history, really. So
yeah, no, well, I'll come to some of those questions a bit later, actually.
But yeah,
really important points you made there about how we, you know, it doesn't make anything good, but it's what we do with it that what comes out of it that actually becomes unexpected. You know, I think so. Whereas a year ago we were all, you know, facing almost the abyss, really, of like what's happening. Our lives are being turned on their head. There's this illness which at that point, you know, we didn't know anybody who'd suffered from it, but we, other than what was in the other than news stories, and then suddenly the whole country was being shut down, and I think that led to a lot of dislocation. But in terms of the actual job that you do, because I was listening to the interview that you did on the radio last week, and you were talking about all the great things you've done with astronauts and being involved in the training of, or sort of, you know, part of your job in teaching is certainly to work with those who go into space. Do you want to say a little bit about what you've done? Because I know you were at Houston before that, but in terms of, you know, some of the great things that you do in your job.
I've been involved with an ARIS link. ARIS is amateur radio on board the International Space Station, and I've been involved with seven connections there. So on seven occasions, we've allowed students to speak live to the International Space Station, to speak to one of the astronauts on board the space station as it's in orbit around the Earth. I've done, let's think now, seven. So I've done four in Houston, one in Wales, and two in Kuwait. And you know, as again, it's these opportunities are there for students to engage and you know, build up excitement about the space program, because I think you know, just aside from pandemic, we're at a turning point in space exploration right now. Virgin Galactic are very, very close to sending their first tourists up into space, and when that happens, then I think, you know, there's going to be a major evolution whereby people can now go into space without having to be an astronaut. They can go into space as a tourist, which, let's face it, back, I'd say about 10 years ago or even longer than that, was only, you know, you could only go up space if you were an astronaut or if you had like billions of dollars to pay for a seat on it. But now, with Virgin Galactic now on the cusp of sending the first space tourists up, it's going to start, you know, really, you know, developing further and further and further. And like I said, what I want to do with my job is I want to inspire the current young people that are here, because they don't know it right now, but we are, I think, looking for a golden age of space exploration, just like we had in the late 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, with you know, going from Apollo to the space lab, just to the space station, to Mir. And of course, then the space shuttle program as well. And you know, these young minds, these talented young students in, and not just in the STEM topics, but in any topic really, are there. And you know, they sometimes, especially now this pandemic has hit, they're going around scratching their heads, thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do. So I'm trying to get these events for my students so they can really see that, yes, there is a path forward. I can do that. I'm interested in that now. I've listened to other people talk about it. And why not me? Why can't I become an aeronautical engineer? Why can't I be involved with astronaut training? Why can't I be involved with the space tourism industry right now? Because it is developing at a faster rate than perhaps people were expecting. Mm-hmm. And like I said, you know, one of these days, I think I mentioned this on the radio interview as well. So one of these days, There's going to be someone that goes into space and or even lands on Mars, and I'll say, I taught that person.
Yeah. Well, and of course you were asked the question I'm going to ask you, do you know, will that person be you? Do you think, could you ever see yourself going up there?
I'd love to go into space, definitely. You know, I want to see, I want to experience zero gravity. I want to see the world as a complete unit. You know, I want to see the curvature of the Earth. I want to see what the landmass looks on Earth and everything. So yeah, so if you know, there's an opportunity that arises, and my whole life, I've since leaving school, whenever opportunities have arisen, I've stood up and I've held my hand up and said, I want to do that. And that's what has got me to some of those experiences, which I'll come to in a second, because I've sent you a couple of pictures about that as well. But yeah, if the opportunity is there, they said, would you like to go into space? Do you want to, you know, do this trip? I'd definitely be at the front of the queue if I possibly can. So just some of those experiences, I've been to the White House, I've been to the Buckingham Palace, I've done a presentation in front of United Nations, and I've been to the cathedral in New York, and I led out the Knights of Malta, and I've jumped out of an aeroplane. I've done all sorts of things, you know, with my life. And it's just like, and sometimes, you know, you look back on things. And as you said earlier on in the interview, Chris, you said, you know, when we were 14 back in the day, you know, maybe there has been someone like guiding us in a sense, but you know, we told each other back in when we were 14, this is what, you know, would have happened in the next 30, 40 years or whatever. There was no way on this planet, pardon the pun, that we would ever, you know, agree that would be what, or believe that I was going to happen or anything like that. So yes, I've been incredibly lucky, but still I've always taken on an opportunity. If there's an opportunity to do something, then I snatch at it. I want to do that, you know?
Yeah. No, I've had the opposite problem in a way, because I've in some ways I've achieved lots and lots and lots of stuff, but I've often done it in one place, and that's interesting.
Oh, right, okay.
and it's more, I think that's starting to change a bit, but it's interesting that I'm somebody who tends to be very good at staying the course in something, which isn't a bad thing by any means. But it also means that in terms of the sort of the life experience, it's just that sometimes you think, go for caution. You know, I stayed in the where I went to university, I stayed there for 10 years. I thought, had a good 3 years, I'll stay for a bit longer. Well, there's actually nothing wrong with that, other than the fact that sometimes there comes a point when you just need to say, hold on, if this is what you want to do, if that's your comfort zone, then stay for it. But if your comfort zone is to do something else, then and we'll, you know, if you were interviewing me, well, you probably know where this is going. But yeah, I sometimes think that you don't want to look back on your life and think, why didn't I grab that metaphorical bull by its horns? Why didn't I seize that day? But now that's interesting. But in that sense, I'm going to jump forward with one of my questions. But do you, in that sense, feel that you have accomplished all of those dreams that you had when you were young? Or do you still entertain thoughts of doing something else?
I still have ambitions to do different things. There's also, I mean, I said to my students when I show them the skydiving video, when I'm teaching terminal velocity, you know, and they're just looking on the screen, just watching, you know, their teacher, their physics teacher, jumping out of an airplane. And they said, you know, do you still want to do it? I said, well, I'd like to do wing walking next. And I'll tell you another story as well. A few years ago, just before I left Houston, in fact, one of my friends, good friends in Houston, she said that she was going for this audition at a local theater. She said, so why don't you come along and you can drive me there and drive me back. I said, okay, I'll come along and I'll accompany you and give you some moral support. So I'm sitting down in the waiting room, and she gets called up for her audition, and they say, oh, you come along too. And I thought, well, I'm not here to audition. I'm just here. Oh, okay. I'll do whatever you need me to do. And so I did this audition, and the next thing I know, I'm playing the lead role in this play in Houston, which I was, you know, absolutely gobsmacked. I never had any acting experience before. You know, I said, I'm just a teacher, you know, I just like perform in front of students if I can and try and get them entertained in physics or, you know, whatever. And then as a result of that, then somebody said, why don't you stay and audition for the next show, which is Shakespeare? So I said, okay. And then when I left Houston, I said goodbye to my friends there, and I got to Kuwait, and I was chatting to the new drama teacher, and I said, "Oh, I did a couple of shows in Houston," and she said, "Why don't you come along to this audition for the pantomime?" So okay, fair enough. So I went along to this audition for the pantomime, just thinking I might be in the chorus or something, and once again, I got selected for a lead role. I was wishy-washy in the pantomime, and I've done I think about 10 shows now since. In across the world, not in the UK, and that led to being in a movie last year as well. So these opportunities, you don't know where these connections take themselves in the future or whatever. But I am starting to get worried in that out of the 10 shows I've done, 9 of them I've played an idiot. So I don't know if that's ever getting typecast. I don't know, but I hope not. But yeah, as I said, it's challenging, to stand up in front of an audience and remember the lines and just be yourself sometimes as well. And when I was in school, I never ever dreamed that I would do anything like that at all. It just wasn't my thing, As I said, I was into science, I was into maths, and that's all I thought I was ever going to do. I wanted to do something with the space industry, and now, as you said, we're looking back now on all these opportunities that I've these wonderful opportunities that I've been handed to me, and not realizing just how much I've done since being at school. It's absolutely phenomenal. I just can't believe it. Hopefully it continues. I say, obviously, when the pandemic eases, then hopefully here that we can start doing some more shows here in Abu Dhabi if I can. But we'll see.
No, because about a year and a half ago, I did a we called it Nostalgia Night, and it was actually a colleague of mine who came up with
Oh
the
yeah.
idea. And we have a live show of music, but I would compare it and do it in my own,
All right. Okay.
and it would be like my nostalgia interviews,
Yes.
but as a live show with clips from the podcast, but also
Yeah.
having people who were guests of mine coming up and doing readings and talking about, for example, one of them read from Dickens and the Christmas. It
Okay,
was
yeah.
actually only about a month before Christmas, so she read from the Christmas Carol, and we had a little sort of like a song from the Muppet Christmas Carol. So
Okay,
it
yeah.
all fitted really well. And I thought, I did this, and I thought I'd never done anything quite like that before. But I thought, could get used to this. It's interesting because I'm used to standing up in front of an audience and teaching,
Absolutely,
but
yeah.
but this was a chance for me to do the very thing. It's very interesting actually, because I always think that in my own research, often you deal with ideas, and you look at what people have said in books, and sort of you
Yeah.
look at their ideas, their arguments, why they're important. Not so much of the biographies. In recent years, I'm often going to those same people I work with, or people who've many of the people are in my field in religious studies, and you talk about you ask the very questions that I'm asking you, and
Yeah.
then and it does of course have a bearing on your sense of. It's more for me interesting, how do people end up where they are now? Why are they doing?
That's
What's
right.
the thing that gets them up in the morning? What's the motivation? Rather
Yeah.
than just saying, oh, this is their latest monograph. It's the journey there, which I don't,
Yeah.
I think I've always been interested in, but it never really articulated. But now, realize that I need to fill in those gaps. So you've just done that. But I have to ask, everyone will be looking this up now. What was the film that you were in last year?
Oh, right. Okay. It was an Arabic. Actually, we thought we were filming a horror movie. I was one of the background vampires in this movie. We thought it was a horror movie, but it was an Arabic action movie, action comedy, which then was released in Kuwait last. Well, I say last, sorry, year before last, in the autumn. And I think in cinemas, I think it was only released in Kuwait. But then last March, when the lockdown started, it actually got onto Netflix, and I still have it on Netflix now. So it's on definitely on Netflix in the Middle East. I'm not sure about the rest of the world, but it's on Netflix in the Middle East, and it's called The End. I'm not sure what it's called in Arabic, but it's called The End, set in Kuwait, and it reached, I think it was number 3 trending in Kuwait on Netflix, I think, when I checked last April, I think, when we had the lockdown. I went to see it in the cinema, and all those times we sat in the cinema, Chris, watching movies, never ever in my life did I think I'd sit in a cinema and see myself on the big screen, even just for a brief second, just see myself there. I've always wanted to be in a Bond film, so you never know. Maybe I'll start looking at extras in the in Bond. Obviously, not this current one, but we shall see, and possibly a music video. I don't know. We'll see.
Isn't it lovely though, actually, that you can, after all these years, that same sort of sense of enthusiasm has never gone away. And I think it's, you're right. We used to, and perhaps just very briefly, because I've got so many things. I'm just conscious of time. I don't want to go on beyond another 10-15 minutes. But I'm fascinated to ask about films. What was the first film that you remember seeing?
Oh gosh, I think there were two. Now there were two films in 1978 that came out. And my mum's sisters, my two aunties, who I still keep contact every single week, even to this day now, even on WhatsApp and that, they were really keen to take me to see. And I can't remember which order they were, but they were both released in 1978. I just can't remember which one was first, but one was Grease and one was Superman, the movie. And I'd have to look up which one was released first, but that was my first film I saw in the cinema. I also saw a couple of Disney movies around about that time as well, which they traditionally would come out about Christmas time. So I don't think it was a Disney movie. I think it was one of those. I think it was my first movie I went to see. And the most recent one I seen was the movie I was in, The End. That's the one I've seen the most recently in the cinema, obviously because of lockdown during the pandemic. You know, so.
Yeah, oh, you can't better that, can you? So actually, you realise that you can't go back to the cinema now because it's always going to be...
Not at all, I know.
The movies can never be the same. We watched, and 93, we went about five or six times. That's what we saw. Yeah. Actually, films that actually I still watch and rate very highly, The Line of Fire. I remember we saw...
Yes, we saw that,
in September of 93, we saw The Crush. With Silverstone. The murder thing. So I Married an Ex-Murderer.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes.
And Splitting Heirs, which...
I remember Splitting Heirs, yeah, that's right.
Which was a peculiarly watchable, but...
Eric Idle, I know,
And that famous line with Catherine Zeta-Jones when she says, do you want to come up to my apartment for sex? And he says, don't you mean for coffee? He said, no, but I'll come up for coffee. And for 30 odd years on, I'm...
Absolutely. Yeah, I know. My goodness me.
In my mind. But just we start to wrap up, Chris, in terms of, questions around nostalgia. I mean, would you say that your memories, as you look back on your life and your career, are predominantly positive ones?
I think so. As I said, some of these experiences I look back and I sometimes forget. Like, have you on your phone, a smartphone, it'll pop up a memory or something. And you're like, oh yeah, I remember that. I did that. And you just think, wow, I did that. I do look back on memories, even at school. As I said, that. Anticipation on Monday mornings, you said, having listened to the charts the night before. There's no social media, there's no WhatsApp. We had to wait until we saw each other face to face in the mornings and talk about what's gone in as a highest new entry at number one, for instance. It was those moments, having discussion about the politics of the day. After, again, on a Sunday evening, if you remember, Chris, there was the show Spitting Image. And of course, we talk about the sketches and the betrayals the following morning, and
Kenneth Baker as the slug.
Yes, that's right. And I remember watching, I think I was watching a nostalgia interview many years ago about, it was either about Spitting Image or it was about the year that Spitting Image was released, I think. And I think it was somebody, I think it was Ian Hislop, I think, but I could be wrong, saying that the most unexpected thing that they found as a consequence of showing Spitting Image on TV was the fact that the following day you had people in playgrounds talking about politics of the day, when normally they wouldn't have been talking about politics of the day. They'd be talking about something else. And it just, that encapsulated it. And as I said, that you can't bring back those things. I mean, nowadays, as you said, there's so much connection around the world. There's something happens, you're going to know about it within a second because someone's going to WhatsApp it or someone's going to tweet it or it's going to be on Instagram or Snapchat or anything like that. But I think, back in those days when you had to wait, I suppose you could have phoned each other, but you had to wait until seeing each other at school and really having that social aspect. And I just wonder whether social networking has made us less social. I don't know. What do you think on that? What's your take on that?
It depends how you look at it, because I'm now in contact with, like yourself and people I went to university with, who I wasn't in contact with for years. And I did it on a daily basis. So that on a daily basis, people who I was once able to see physically in university campus, etc., now I'm in contact with. And that is completely different. I mean, that in a way, compared to where I was in my life, say, 5 years ago. So in a way, I've got a much wider body of friends than was the case. A lot of my family members are not really on Facebook. So actually, really, Facebook is almost entirely friends rather than family members, where a telephone call or a text message seems to be much more the way to keep in touch. So there have been many steps forward. One plus, I think, with a lot of social media is that sometimes you kind of see what people are like at root. It's almost as though the interest that they have, you sort of think, that's so them. You know, you sort of think, or you think, oh, they haven't changed at all. And that, in a changed world, you know, they've got the differences. They may have families now. They've got, they live in different places. Their lives are completely different in the sense that they're now older and have those sort of responsibilities. But at heart, what Facebook does is kind of show, and whether it's politically, because that's the one area I try to keep away from. On the few occasions when I have put up more political stuff, you end up with people then, I remember putting something up before the general election in the UK in 2019, and then some friends completely fell out. Well, they didn't necessarily know each other. They were friends of mine, but they were just having a massive argument with each other on Facebook about the about who to vote for in Canterbury is a very, very marginal seat. So, of course, it was like, no, you have to vote Labour or whatever it might be. You know, even if you don't like the Labour candidate, you know, don't let the Tories in, that sort of thing. And there was a lot of that. So, but it also means, I think sometimes, and this is the downside I find to it, if you're in Facebook contact with people and then suddenly perhaps people stop liking your posts, or people stop, whether they're liking somebody else's post but not yours, what it also brings back is the whole like classroom thing. If that person spoke to me, or that person gave me a birthday card, and that
never got one from them.
And there's all of that, and I find that interesting. Like some people, you know, will always comment on some people's posts but not other people, even when they've been actually tagged into a post.
Right. Okay.
And part of me also just thinks, no, I'm not. You know, I don't think that's the healthy part.
True, true. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've lived in Texas before, and now, of course, I'm living in the Middle East, so I know there are two things you never discuss: politics and religion.
And actually, it's funny because I obviously teach religious studies, but I'm always careful in the podcast not to overtly talk about that. But I'm always interested in what does or does not. And of course, we went to church school, which
of course,
is something very interesting about our own sort of heritage that sense. And I obviously ended up sticking with the very subject that I particularly enjoyed at school, which was a very minority subject. In that, when I did A level, we had a bumper year. There were about five or six of us doing A level.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, which says, you know, unlike your subject, for example, where, you know, in physics, where you're obviously in a much bigger class. So it's a different sort of yardstick.
True. But also, I remember our optional, when we were in the sixth form, I remember our optional religious studies classes that we went along to were more of a discussion with Miss Rose. And it was her teaching that I found out about. You know, the Islam before arriving here in the Middle East, you know. So I remember quite correctly when she was telling us about, because I remember she chose a different religion each week. And, you know, so it was, you know, it was religious studies were still very interesting at that time. And just and listening to what she said about the factual aspects of the the different religions that we studied still you know, stay with me even to this day, and some of my students both in Kuwait and here in the UAE are you know, impressed that I are able to know so much about different religions, not just Islam. There's you know, obviously the predominant religion in this part of the world, but and I said, yeah, I go back to the sixth form classes that I had, and of course attended with yourself. So
I remember those. We used to have, like, on Thursday mornings or whatever it was, we'd have this class where I was doing A-level RE at the time, but those who weren't, it was still an opportunity to ensure that the very sort of grounding, the ethos of the school was able to carry on when obviously people were specializing in other subjects. So no, it's how in. Well, I've lost contact with pretty much all the teachers, and you know, obviously, if those who are still alive would be quite old now, but I'm sure they'd be really delighted.
I think Mr. Davis, who was our Welsh teacher, I think my sister said, I think she was speaking to him recently, or he's just recently retired. I'll have to check the messages, but he was still there recently. And I think he knew about Emily being my niece. So he's I think he's still there at some point. But I think I think you're right. All the teachers that we had, I think, are not at the school anymore. But
I think at one point, and I'd have to do it pretty soon in that sense, because obviously they'd all be in their 70s and 80s now. They'd have to be, really. But I wouldn't mind actually going back and if any of them were ever interested in having this sort of a conversation. It'd be very odd to turn the tables, but many years have passed. What about the converse to the question about memories being predominantly positive? Can you be nostalgic about negative experiences?
I think you can. I think to a degree, like I said, there are sometimes in your life where perhaps you've like had an embarrassing moment, for instance. You look back and you think, oh, you know, I remember listening to that song, and you think about it and you laugh about it that time. So I think to a degree you can be nostalgic about negative experiences in your life. I mean, other times there are some aspects that you don't really want to remember, and perhaps hearing something or having a certain smell or something or a certain movie or something, for instance, you know, just takes you back to that time. You think, oh, I don't really want to think about that, you know. But I think, you know, on some occasions, I think it can be. But like I said, it depends on what it is. It depends on that, you know, on the type of aspect in your life that it was, you know, really. So
I think that's right, because I think sometimes we obviously want to accentuate the things that matter, or we find. I'm always doing this, and I'm conscious that I was talking to somebody the other day about this. And like I was listening in my car to something I'd recorded in December '92, and that, you know, the Whitney Houston song came on, you know, the one that was number one for 9 weeks, whatever, and that came on, and I thought, very good. And I was just thinking, oh, I think I prefer the Dolly Parton version. Fine, switch the radio off. And what came on, literally, this was about 8:15 on a Friday. It was a special Sounds of the 80s thing. It was like a musical special. And they were playing the Dolly Parton song. Mm.
Yeah.
And I thought, how weird. Although, obviously, that was 70s, but whatever it was, anyway, it was playing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I thought, this is really odd. And I have a lot of those moments of synchronicity where particular songs or particular things come on the radio at particular times, or I look back and you start seeing these patterns. But somebody's pointed out to me, they said, the trouble is, if you're looking out for them or you're aware of them and you write them down, then, you know, with a lot of people wouldn't perhaps necessarily process them in the same way. So it's more that you're open to them rather than the fact that they're happening to you to a particularly exaggerated degree.
That's it. Yeah. Definitely. No, I agree. Yeah.
I've just got a couple more questions. One of them is, well, a stupid one to ask. I've already asked you whether you're still in touch with friends from your past. Well, we are here. I've answered my own question. But but what about the question as to whether you're a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Ooh, I think it's difficult. It's difficult to say. I mean, I always think to myself, you glance back and you focus forward, because, you know, you don't forget your roots. Don't forget where you're from, what you did in the past, you know, and what has happened to you as a person in the past has made your character today. But then you also want to look forward and think, right, what am I going to do next? What's going to be my next challenge? What's going to be my next character building or character defining achievement, in a sense, you know? So I'm always looking, as I said, looking to do new things. But like I said, you know, be aware of what you've done in the past. There are some things that you can bring with, you know, your experience. You can bring to a team. You can bring to a group. You can bring, you know, to someone's life and make their life better as a result of it. So I think, I probably predominantly I try to look forward, but still, you know, I still got that memory and that recall. So if I need to, I'm sure I can dig some memory out of my brain somewhere.
Yeah. Well, Chris, it has been so exceptionally wonderful. After we shouldn't have left it so long.
No, I know.
But to catch up for a nostalgia interview, this has been the highlight of my lockdown. So, Chris, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
My pleasure. Thank you ever so much, Chris. It's been an absolute privilege to make contact with you once again and contribute to your wonderful podcast series.